doctorate work on the Family Abuse Prevention Act and a study on how Oregon's law has worked, and has concluded this was done 2 years ago, that domestic homicides in Oregon are down 10% in a time when they could be expected to go up. And since the homicide statistics are the only firm statistics that she had, because we don't separate out stats on assault sorts of cases, whether domestic violence or not, the homicides are the best thing that we have to trace, and they in fact appear to be down since implementation of the law. Before explaining the amendments in 400 and responding to the concerns that were raised immediately preceding my testimony, I guess I should give you a little bit of background about how the law works. It's three-tiered. It's first what the police do when they arrive at the scene of a domestic disturbance, and that is an issue in this bill. But they have to, if they have probable cause to believe that an assault has been committed, they have to arrest the suspected perpetrator of that assault. The idea is not to have police out there mediating anymore, but to separate out the parties. And there's been a lot of study, a very good project that was done in Duluth, or Minneapolis, excuse me, that's actually the very best way to intervene and stop future violence, is to separate them out. Okay, step two is what we're dealing with in Senate Bill 400, and that's the court response, and that is the restraining order process. And basically, the victim of domestic violence goes to the judge or the court, and there are forms available at the courthouse, and the procedure is free, and they fill out the forms, and then they're given a hearing that day or the next day, where they have to explain to the court what the alleged abuse was. And if the court finds that there's imminent and present danger of abuse, that the petitioner is endangered, then they can award certain relief. Now, when that order is entered, the respondent has time to respond and get a hearing on that ex parte order. And if they don't request a hearing, then the order remains in effect. Okay. Then the next step is if the order is violated. The police are called to the scene, and the person that the restraining order has been entered against is there, then the police are obligated to remove that person. And the district attorney is obligated to help in the pursuit of that contempt proceeding. Okay? So you have what the police do, what the courts do, and what the district attorney does once the order has been violated, if there aren't any criminal charges filed, that the contempt is a civil contempt. Okay? So what we have in Senate Bill 400 are some fairly technical amendments to what happens with the court restraining order process. Now, people that are eligible for restraining orders are spouses, former spouses, adult persons related by blood or marriage, that's the quote granny bashing situation, or persons cohabiting with each other, living with each other at the time, or who have cohabited with each other within the immediate preceding year. Okay, the problem with that is the immediate preceding year. And we want to remove that because, well, let me give you an example. We had a client, she was 17 years old, she never married this person, she had a child with him, he just disappeared basically off the face of the earth for 4 years. He came back and started physically abusing her and just generally making her life absolutely miserable. Now, she is not eligible under the current law for Family Abuse Prevention Act order. They're not related by blood or marriage, they haven't lived with each other within the immediately preceding year, and they never married. And this woman really needs an order, and the judge basically said, I'm rather sympathetic, but I can't give you one. And that's what we're trying to address in the First Amendment on page 1, that appears at line 13-14. Okay?
Did I interrupt?
Representative Phillips?
Were you telling me that you couldn't get a restraining order for any reason if somebody, or just under this act?
Okay. One of the reasons that the Family Abuse Prevention Act came into effect was, you could possibly get an order, and we have done one in a couple of cases that weren't covered before, that adults related by blood or marriage, in fact, was the case that I did one, and it took me 2 months in a sheaf of papers this high to get a protective order for a woman who was being physically abused by her returning from Vietnam son, who just went totally bonkers. So it can be done. There's also a question in the law if you can restrain people from committing tortuous acts in the future. I mean, it's not real clear under law that you can even get a restraining order, though in a couple of truly egregious cases, we in fact have.
Thank you.
Okay. Now, the Second Amendment, which starts on page 1 at lines 21 and goes all the way through to page 2, line 6. Now, we're talking about a self-help proceeding here. And so we have to have as many things on the form that are going to tell the judge about any problem areas. And one problem area that we've picked up, and we survey every odd year all of the shelters and try and talk to judges and get a committee together to go through all of the problems that we've come up against, was that sometimes people don't realize that they can't use a Family Abuse Prevention Act order to change an existing custody order. Somebody else legitimately has custody, you know, they can't use a Family Abuse Prevention Act order to change custody. Or that the kids have been... Anyway, so what we've done is we want the petition to disclose if there are any other Family Abuse Prevention Act proceedings pending, any annulment, any dissolution or separation, anything pending between the parties. We also want them to disclose where the kids have been living for the preceding, immediately preceding 6 months, and whom they've been living with. And that's to make sure that we have on the face of the pleadings enough facts that are going to alert the court to ask questions. Just to make sure that we get all of the relevant data just out in the open. Questions? Okay, the next amendment appears at line 9. Now I kind of feel that the lead case on Family Abuse Prevention Act orders comes out of Missouri, and it's a very thorough analysis upholding the constitutionality of Missouri statute at a court that's not really famous for issuing radical sorts of decisions. But anyway, they sustained a 15-day limitation in that law on the time that when respondent requests a hearing, they get one. The coalition has always wanted something built into the statute that would guarantee respondents a speedy hearing. And it's been left to local court rule, and in practice, Oklahoma County is 15 days, I think in Lane County is 21, and they generally happen quite quickly. But I've got to tell you, my nightmare is I'm going to have a case go up from some court that improperly issued an order, and somebody didn't get a hearing for 3 months. I mean, I don't want to have to write the brief in that case. I would really like to have the Oregon law within the letter of an Abuse Prevention Act that's been constitutionally sustained. And I think it's a good insurance policy to put that respondents are entitled to a hearing within a short period of time. I just want to err on the side of caution on this point. The next amendment is that restraining orders continue in effect for 1 year. Now, last session, the legislature intended to do that, and they amended the form to make them 1 year, but didn't amend the enabling statute. And one of the reasons for making them automatically 1 year is because when they get entered into the computer, sometimes there would be a mix-up on how long the order was good for, et cetera, et cetera. And there were also problems in some parts of the state, that still are, with judges that only grant them for a very short period of time, and it's just not enough time for people to cool off. And in a year, it is generally sufficient. Last session, to take care of the situation, where people didn't want it to continue for a whole year, they reconciled for whatever reason to feel that they needed, we put in a form in the statute that would allow people to have the order rescinded. So we took care of two-thirds of the problem, but we didn't grant the, we didn't write it into the enabling part of the statute. And that's what the amendments at lines 20 and 30 would do on that page. Now, the amendments at line 4 are the self-help petition itself. This is what the petitioner fills out and presents to the court. And the language there at page 4 tracks what's in the enabling provision and is the actual form that the petitioner fills out and tells to the court, you know, where the kids have been or what proceedings are pending and the like, and who and the kids are residing with. Now, the next amendments...
Excuse me, Representative Phillips.
Who checks up on these forms for accuracy?
Okay, it depends a little, it's a county by county procedure, actually. Some counties, Multnomah County, actually has a person that helps petitioners fill out the forms. Judge Bonebreak is here from Hillsborough, and I think that they have somebody, too, that looks over the forms. But the court analyzes these forms and decides whether or not to issue the order.
Okay.
The next significant amendment is on page 9. Now, the amendment which appears in section 6 and the amendment that appears at line 6 are related. Under the present situation, the order remains open for the whole year. And that's presented a problem for petitioners because 6 months down the line, the respondent goes, oh, I think I'd like a hearing on this, asks for a hearing. Petitioner is long gone, and when the court sends out notice that the thing has been sent for hearing, she doesn't show up. So what she finds out that there isn't an order in effect anymore because the respondent requested a hearing that she never came for. You know, that's exactly when she's probably going to need that order. It's when she calls the police and they say, sorry, ma'am, there isn't an order in the computer. Excuse me for saying she and he, because about 95% of the time, it's she that's petitioner, and about 5% of the time, it's he. But, so I'm just using it the way it statistically generally works out. Okay, now, the problem with, if you limit to 30 days, just like any other court proceeding for requesting a hearing, I think that we've put respondents in sort of a tough spot, too, because they may not actually contest the order right away, and they may not have a complaint with it, but 6 months down the line, the respondent may say, well, you know, we didn't really deal with visitation in the Family Abuse Prevention Act order, or I think that maybe I should have custody after all. And we didn't, if we just close it up, then for the whole year, it stays closed. And it should be like other domestic relations provisions, that if you notify the other party, that they should be able to modify custody or visitation. And I think that that's an important way that we can balance the respective interests to make sure that petitioners don't lose the protection of their orders, and also to make sure if there's any change in circumstances that the court should address, short of filing a divorce proceeding. And sometimes we have respondents and petitioners that aren't married, so we don't have any other proceeding for them to be in court to debate the issue in. I'm really concerned about some of the amendments that were presented by Representative Young. They were initially put into Senate Bill 536, which is still in the Senate Judiciary Committee, and Senate Judiciary Committee put out the amendments that were in 400 and has not heard 536. If you want me to analyze the reasons why some of those amendments policy-wise wouldn't work, I'd be glad to do that.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Paulson. Are there any other questions at this point? If not, thanks again.
I guess one thing more that the committee would like to, the coalition would like to say is to really thank the legislature for, since 77, working so hard on this law and making it one of the leaders in the whole country. And it does work. Oftentimes, what a lot of these people need is for a court or someone in a uniform to say, you just can't do that. It is illegal to beat up your spouse in this state. And it's amazing what sometimes just that piece of paper saying you are restrained from doing this will do for some people. Thank you.
Representative Miller.
I'd just like to comment that Ms. Paulson apologized for dumping her materials on us. I'd like to frankly thank her. I think they're very valuable and appreciate it.
Okay. That'll be noted for the record. Judge Bumbrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Al Bonebrake. I'm Circuit Court Judge, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Judicial Conference on this bill. And I'll be brief. Most of the amendments that are included here and to the present law are what I'd call fine-tuning, trying to cover some of the difficulties that have arisen. The major ones that we were interested in have to do with the bottom of the page 1, section 3, which would now include a requirement in the petition that the petitioners let us know, advise us, whether or not there is another order that that person knows about that's in effect that already affects custody of the children. And information also going on to page 2 as to who are the children presently residing with and who have they resided with for the last 6 months and where have they resided, because there have been abuses. Where a petitioner will come in, a person who is not in custody of the children, has not had custody of the children, and ask for custody, and frankly, the cases have slipped by, and that person has obtained custody. The sheriff then goes out, helps enforce the order, and that person gets custody of the children when that person has not had custody of those children for some time. So this would require the petitioner to give us that information. It would have to be on the petition. If that information is known to the petitioner, another order that's in effect, they've got to tell us, and they have to affirmatively set forth without us asking and without the fear of us forgetting to ask in a particular case, who have the children resided with, where have they been for the last period of time, 6 months or so, and where are they residing presently. We do have some problems, we have some question about a couple of sections. One of them is section 3, the requirement of having a hearing within 14 days. Now, if the respondent asks for a hearing, there's certainly a necessity of having a hearing as soon as practicable. Tying us to a period of 14 days is going to cause difficulty in some of the counties. And then I think it's fair to say most of the counties west of the Cascades, we're not having too much problem. We would not. There are some counties, though. Judge Jackson, I believe, from over at Baker expressed a real concern because he travels a lot of having to go to some county for a 10-minute hearing just so that he can meet the 14-day deadline. He might have to travel a couple hundred miles. And I know it's important to have these as soon as possible, but we are going to have some difficulty in implementing that 14-day rule in some of the counties if that passes. Going on down then to in section 3, there, the middle of page 2, there are judges who believe that they ought to have the discretion to set the period of the restraining order will remain in effect up to a period of 1 year. This does take away that discretion. If the amendments that are in the present bill pass, all restraining orders will be automatically for a period of 1 year. And there are situations where doesn't seem necessary to have them remain in effect for that long. Frankly, it's not uncommon for people, once restraining orders are had, to reconcile, and it's not an unknown situation to have someone arrested when these parties have reconciled because of some technical violation of the order where they're found to be in violation, where it's not really the intention of the parties anymore, the thing remain in effect, but the petitioner may not have come back to court and asked to have the proceeding dismissed. The officer's hands are tied. He's required to arrest the person if he's found that person technically to have violated the order that's in effect. So it does happen. Judges would prefer that they have the discretion
to set the period of time that the order ought to remain in effect for a period of time not to exceed 1 year. That's the present statutory language, and so I would say that we do oppose that amendment that would make an automatic period of 1 year. That really concludes my comments. We do, frankly, support the bill. We have questions about those two provisions, though, that I've just discussed.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you.
Questions? What's the bill?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Judge Bumbrake, what, if not 14 days, what would you suggest?
Yeah, I, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hill, I thought someone would probably ask me that, and I don't know what to suggest, except that I'd prefer language, some language indicating that at the earliest possible, earliest practical time that the court would set that hearing. I know there are other statutes. It's not uncommon, not unknown for the legislature to require statutory language that something be given a priority on the court's docket. I can't think of them right offhand. I know there are other statutes because I've seen them before that require that sort of language, something similar here that would require an expedited hearing, but not set it at 14 days, I think would be what our preference is. There's a need to have a quick hearing on some of these because some of them are taken. People representing themselves, frankly, abuse the statute. They come in and get an order, and it's a real hardship on the other person, and that respondent needs to get into court quick. But 14 days is going to cause problems. I can't be more definite than that, except that some language to indicate that it needs to be given a priority on the court's docket.
Just a follow-up question, then we'll recognize Representative Phillips. Judge, how often are these things, or I know we're handling more and more motions without oral argument, and in fact, telephone conferences are being encouraged for purposes of some motions. Is this something that might be handled with a telephone conference? Or
the hearing itself?
Yeah.
I haven't done any telephone conferences for the hearings themselves when a respondent asks for a hearing. I have not. I'll be honest with you again, frank with you, I have difficulty with the telephone conference in some of these situations. It's real. We're dealing here ordinarily with people that are unrepresented by counsel, and have a real difficult time determining the credibility of witnesses in court, let alone over the telephone. When there's something about having attorneys, when attorneys have told them, look, you're going to take an oath, you're going to have to testify and be truthful here, and it means a lot to people, but emotions run high. These are domestic violence cases. Emotions run high. People get unreasonable sometimes, and it's not unknown for someone, frankly, to lie, and it's difficult enough when they're in court. Handling that over the telephone is going to leave a lot to be desired.
Okay. Representative Phillips.
Back to the 14 days, Judge. Seems to me, first of all, I don't know where that was picked, other than some use 15 and what the magic to 14 is. But does it cause, forgetting the Eastern Oregon situation, does it cause you any difficulty when we say a flat 14 days without talking about weekends or holidays or any of those other type of things when you're talking about getting these on an expedited process? Would it be better to say 15 days including holidays and weekends? That way you always know you're talking about work days and when it will be scheduled. Would that be a better way to address it or not?
Well, I think it's Mr. Chairman, Representative Phillips, it's safe to say that the longer a period of time the court had, the easier it is going to be for a judge to schedule in some of those less populous counties. There's no doubt about that. If we had 15 judicial days, we're talking about 3 weeks. I think the tendency, though, of the legislature recently in dealing with periods of limitation or periods of time in court is to, and I may be wrong, but to try to set periods of time of calendar days so that we're not stuck with trying to determine what the judicial days are and that sort of thing. So you could defer to your legal counsel here on that. I think the trend in drafting has been not to count in terms of judicial days, but in terms of calendar days, and to round them off to weeks to 7-day period so that you know that the period of limitation is always going to come up on the same day that the initial action was taken. So if it's taken on a Tuesday, it's going to come up on a Tuesday. That's probably why the 14 days we put here. It's easier to remember those periods of limitation or definite days.
Okay. Any further questions? Okay. It's my understanding that Senator Cohen hopes to join us on this bill about 3 p.m. So if necessary, we'll reopen the hearing then or when she is able to join us. Let me ask, we'll try to schedule this for a hearing and work session next week. Ms. Paulson, would it be possible for you and the judge to perhaps let us know if you're going to be able to reach any resolution of a couple of issues the judge pointed out, or if not, if you could share that information with us also? Anyone else on Senate Bill 400? Mr. Sandrock.
Mr. Chair, I'm Pete Sandrock, and I'd like to testify on the bill only as the Benton County District Attorney, not as representative of the ODAA. For a number of years, our office assisted petitioners in obtaining these orders, and only last year, as a result of budget cuts, did we have to forego that service. Based upon that 4 or 5 years of experience dealing with these situations, it's our belief that the bill as written with regard to expanding the eligibility of petitioners to simply those who have cohabited with each other without regard to the one-year limitation is an important and needed change, because we have dealt with a number of cases in the past in which the cohabitation occurred more than a year ago, but the kind of violence that is occurring is clearly related to the domestic issues of that union. Thank you.
Any questions? If not, thank you very much. Anyone else on Senate Bill 400? Okay, if not, let's move on in our agenda, and the next bill up is 2660. Council, I understand there are amendments prepared.
Yes. Have some folks signed up. Mr. Watson, Mr. Snyder, Chair Bowman, if all three of you would like to come up together. Glad to hear from you at this time. There are, I think, three possible things included in 2660, and we've used 2660 to try to pull together several different ideas represented in a couple bills and some other amendments which have to do with providing more flexibility in terms of agreements that can be reached between counties and also the state in terms of community correction programs, as well as other regional facilities to deal with sentenced offenders. And I guess, Mr. Watson, you've got a couple of the amendments. If you'd like to, it's been a few weeks since we had this bill up for hearing. If you'd like to maybe just remind us again as to the need for this bill from your division's perspective and speak to those amendments. I appreciate hearing from you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Bob Watson, Administrator of the Correctional Division. House Bill 2660 does three things. It allows the division to retain, to reallocate the community corrections penalty payback money that now returns to the state from counties that are participating in the act when they commit a Class C felon to the state's prisons. it requires these reallocated funds, which only go then to participating counties, to spend them on new or enhanced renovating programs that would assist in the reduction of commitments to the prisons, and that these funds will not be counted in the percentage share that the Act now uses to distribute this money. The division's interest is simply this, that we are now putting some pretty severe notice out to the counties with regard to performance. Each county now must submit a plan for how it will spend the money, sets goals for itself and what it will achieve with the expenditure of that money. And the board, in reviewing the plans, they've been to Salem for review, to Roseburg for review, and next Friday will be in Bend. The notice to the counties is that we better achieve those goals, otherwise we'll start thinking of reallocation of that money removing from those counties funds where they're not performing up to what they said they would do. We think this bill would permit us then to balance that negative message with a positive one, and we're going to reward those counties that are high performers and high producers and kind of balance that message out there that the Act needs, I think, to sustain itself. The amendments, and I don't know which one you have first, Mr. Chairman, I just make it.
Why don't we, Council, can you share a copy with Mr. Watson so